Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Attorney General Jeff Sessions goes before the same Senate committee today that former FBI Director James Comey testified to last week. What can we anticipate in the ongoing investigation of the alleged collusion between Russia and the Trump administration or Trump campaign, or what I call the anti-Russia witch hunt raging in Washington, D.C.? Amid economic crisis, Puerto Rico voted Sunday in a referendum on joining the United States as a state, but with voter turnout at only 23% and most other parties boycotting it, does the vote really reflect the will of the people of Puerto Rico? Bernie Sanders has gone on the offensive, at least in a rhetorical offensive, in the aftermath of Jeremy Corbyn's success in the UK election. Are radical left-wing ideas more successful in stopping the far right than establishment centrism? But first, we turn to Jeff Sessions' appearance before the Senate Intelligence Committee. We are joined from New York by editorial cartoonist and columnist Ted Rawl. Welcome back, Ted.
Thanks for having me.
Ted, what do you expect? Jeff Sessions, surprisingly, at least according to the media reports, the Senate was surprised. The Democrats were surprised that Sessions asked to testify, and he is going to testify. He'll be the highest ranking Trump administration official testifying so far. What's going on?
What's clearly going on here is a not quite rats fleeing from a sinking ship, because the ship's not quite sinking, but the ship's taking on a little bit of water. And as happens in official Washington, these longtime operators are looking out for their own personal self-interest. And you're starting to see a civil war within the Trump administration. I think Jeff Sessions is looking out for Jeff Sessions. In the wake of the James Comey testimony, which I think most people agreed that he acquitted himself pretty well. He now all eyes are turning towards Sessions because he recused himself from this investigation, and everyone wants to know why and exactly what is behind that recusal. And they also want to talk. And of course, Comey pointed straight at Sessions last week in his testimony before the committee, saying that he asked Jeff Sessions to provide CYA cover for him in that meeting with Trump, that famous Valentine's Day meeting in which Trump asked to speak to Comey one-on-one. And Comey was very uncomfortable with that, and he wrote that famous memo to file. And so everyone's going to say, well, Jeff, so why didn't you sit there with Jim? And so I think that's just the beginning of the questions. But there's a lot of feeling that, you know, if they shake Jeff Sessions six ways till Sunday, a few tasty coins will fall out of his pocket. They're not really sure exactly what they'll be, but these investigations tend to take a life of their own, as Bill Clinton could attest.
You know, I wonder about James Comey acquitting himself. I know that's the take in the media, and I can see in some ways, but there were very interesting parts of Comey's testimony that goes against the dominant narrative. Including in his prepared 7-page testimony, Comey reveals, for instance, that the first time he meets with Trump, he's the one who cleared the room. He's the one who cleared the room and got all of the other officials out, so that this was in January, I think, 6th or 7th, before Trump actually takes office. And he clears the room and he sits with Trump and he goes over the FBI investigation, including the salacious reports that Donald Trump was with hookers in Moscow, et cetera, et cetera, and wants to make Trump aware of the report. In other words, Trump is new. He's now about to become president. He hasn't been meeting as a politician or knowing the ropes necessarily about politics in Washington. So here he has the FBI director clearing the room. And isn't it possible that then the next time when Trump wants to talk to Comey about Mike Flynn and about whatever he said to Mike Flynn, and there's disputes about that, but the media report is that he said, I hope you can see a way to let Mike Flynn go, basically, that he clears the room. And then Comey in his testimony is like, he's shocked, he's nervous, he doesn't know what to do. He needs the attorney general to CYA, in other words, cover for him and make sure he's never left alone again with Trump. But he was the one who started meeting with Trump alone. That was his decision.
Yeah, that's true. It definitely muddies the water. And in a if you're trying to, as a Democrat, to game out a possible impeachment route, you can see that this particular charge, or what they know so far, at least from this episode, doesn't make it an airtight case by any means. I think it would flop both politically and certainly legally. But although impeachment is a political process, not a legal one, so I think that's right. Right. There were other things that made me just think, well, you know, that the assurance from Comey to Trump that he need not worry, that he wasn't being personally investigated, also struck me as a little cozier and less independent than Comey is trying to rebrand himself as. So there were definitely some moments like that. But I think in general, a lot of these things play out as a tone. You know, I mean, Hillary Clinton was considered to have acquitted herself well during many hours of testimony in front of the Benghazi committee last year. And really, if you scratch the surface of that assertion, that wasn't really quite true. But she just sat there and looked good. And, you know, it reminds me of the first time I was on national television. I got on the New York City subway afterwards, and this guy says, "Oh, I saw you." And I said, "Oh, what did you think about what I said? And he said, "Oh, I didn't hear what you said. I just saw your head." I think a lot of people just saw Comey's head and liked what they saw.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing, is if you're not really paying attention, or you're just bouncing off of headlines, which of course is what everyone does, because no one's, except, you know, policy wonks or people who are, I don't know, doing what we're doing, like really digging deep into it. You don't have the time. You have jobs and family responsibilities and other interests, so you're not digging deep into this. So you're kind of bouncing off of what it seems like. In other words, what it seems like. One of the things that surprised me about the Comey hearings, and I thought the Republicans would bring it up, is that the right after Trump was fired, the Washington Post headline, this was the day later, he was fired on the 9th of May. This article runs on the 11th. The front page of the Washington Post headline goes all the way across the front page. It says, "Comey sought more resources for Russia probe." Giant banner headline. So then everybody's left with the assumption, well, okay, Trump fired him because he didn't want the Russia investigation to go forward. And this proves it. Comey sought more resources for Russia probe. Blaring Washington Post. But we know after that headline came out that Comey and others in the FBI said, no, that's not true. Certainly others in the FBI said, no, they hadn't sought more resources for the Russia probe. I would have thought the Republicans would have at least asked Comey, is this article that said this, that made the or left the people with the impression that Trump was trying to stop the Russia probe, actually wrong? And Comey would have had to say, yes, it's wrong. But nobody asked him that.
Yeah, you know, if I were President Trump, I wouldn't be terribly psyched about the support that I'm getting from my so-called quote-unquote Republican allies on the committee. It seems to me that, you know, as I said a little earlier, everybody's just looking out for numero uno here. Not a lot of people are demonstrating a lot of loyalty to their own party's president. And I think that's an example. The questioning was not very fierce from the Republican side of Mr. Comey. I think they were afraid of him. And I suspect that it'll probably be even more lackluster with the Jeff Sessions interview, because he's not well liked in official Washington. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, he's definitely not liked. I mean, he's such an out and out racist that when Ronald Reagan appointed him or tried to name him as a federal district court judge from Alabama in the 1980s, he couldn't get through even those hearings because he was, you know, identified as an overt anti-black white racist. That's not very promising. Now in charge of the Justice Department, oh my goodness, and fiercely xenophobic against the immigrant community, but also within the Senate, within the hallowed halls of that Millionaires Club, just generally disliked by a lot of people. Another thing that James Comey said that I thought was extremely important, again, didn't get that much notice, Trump's people picked up on it, but not the Republican Party in general. James Comey said that an article that was published in the New York Times, a very significant article in February, the headline of which was Trump campaign aides had repeated contacts with Russian intelligence. That was what really got this whole next round of investigations going. Trump campaign aides had repeated contacts with Russian intelligence. Big, bold headline in the New York Times in the February. And Comey, when asked about it, said about the article, in the main, it was not true. Then the New York Times had to write an article about it that says James Comey, former FBI director, on Thursday disputed an article that appeared in February in the New York Times about contacts between President Trump advisors and Russian intelligence officials, which, as the Times goes on, said the report of those contacts is now at the heart of the FBI and congressional investigations. That's big news, isn't it?
It is big news, and it doesn't seem to matter much. I mean, I think that what's really going on here is that the impeachment of President Donald Trump was almost a foregone conclusion, regardless of what he was going to actually do to deserve it. It was really like an effect looking for a cause. And Democrats are, and some Republicans, I dare say, I think, are looking for that cause now. And once you have the special prosecutor and special counsel appointed, and you have all these committees doing investigations, and now you have the lawsuit, the emoluments lawsuits filed by the District of Columbia and State of Maryland's Attorney General, you have all sorts of. There's just so many pots boiling so many pots are on the fire. You just assume that one of them will boil and it'll do. It just seems like if I'm Donald Trump, I'm like racing around, trying to put all these things out. It's going to be pretty hard.
Yeah, I agree with you. The New York Times had an article in the Sunday Times, quote, here's the headline, how seven Trump associates have been linked to Russia. And then the subhead, several associates of President Trump are under scrutiny for the Russian connection. So then it lists Jared Kushner, Jeff Sessions, Michael Flynn, Michael Cohen, Paul Manafort, Carter Page, Roger Stone Jr. And then the article says how they are linked. This is like a big flow chart, how they are linked, how they misled officials. Now, here's the last one, Roger Stone. Again, I'm not a fan of Roger Stone. Here's what how he had a link, quote, big headline, had contact on Twitter with a Russian-linked online figure. Next column, how they misled officials. Well, empty. For Carter Page, was wiretapped on suspicion he was acting as a Russian agent. Russian spies tried to recruit him in 2013. How he misled officials, also blanked. Paul Manafort, worked for pro-Russian Ukrainians with a Russian billionaire. Again, how did he mislead officials? It's blank. In other words, it doesn't matter. In other words, all of this stuff are just like the narrative goes on until there's enough juicy something to grab hold of. But it's the public opinion, the dominant narrative is being shaped by people who obviously have a course that they're trying to run. And it seems like the facts actually just don't matter that much.
No, I don't think they do. And the irony here is that this might be one of those situations when we talk about this a year or two from now, in which Trump gets removed from office or is so crippled by everything that's going on that he becomes completely ineffectual, that and it might be over stuff that he didn't even do. And then like the stuff that he did do, he's going to get away scot-free. It's kind of like busting Al Capone on tax evasion. It's you know they want him, and once the prosecutors are the mob is after you, it's pretty hard to get away.
Yeah, indeed. And Donald Trump brought this on himself. Again, he's such a failed political leader. I mean, so up to the task. I mean, Donald Trump thought that the Democrats and Republicans would applaud James Comey's firing because James Comey had just been being trashed by the Democrats for what he did to Hillary Clinton in the run-up to the 2016 election. I mean, all these reports are coming out, and I believe them, that Donald Trump thought this was going to be great, you know, sort of, he wanted to get rid of Comey. He didn't really think, as Comey has now admitted, that it was going to stop the Russia investigation, but he didn't want Comey. He wanted to get his own guy. He thought the Democrats would applaud him because they hate Comey too. Jared Kushner was the one apparently urging him, Jared Kushner, that sage, urging Trump to fire Comey because he thought it would work out well too. I mean, Trump brought this on himself, even though I believe Comey's actual testimony doesn't reveal anything you know, along the lines of what I've been talking about.
It truly is remarkable. I mean, I wrote my column last week and I said this, and I mean it even more than when I wrote it, when I said that this was the best political candidate of my lifetime as a campaigner. But he's just completely incapable of governing. He has no instinct for it whatsoever. And the thing that's interesting to me is that he's not even seeking out the knowledge of people who are all around him. I mean, you know, he didn't need to guess whether the Democrats were going to approve of Comey's firing. He should have asked a few and asked them how they felt. But he didn't. Obviously, he didn't. Anyone could have told him, look, you know, of course we hate Comey when he goes after Hillary. When he goes after you, we're psyched. You know, it's pretty basic. But I don't think that he's I would bet that Donald Trump's probably never read a serious book about American politics all the way through. I think he just doesn't get it. He doesn't understand the system that he's in charge of. And that's probably really, truly the reason he should be impeached. The guy just can't govern.
On Sunday, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said, "You may be the first president in history to go down because you can't stop inappropriately talking about an investigation that, if you were just quiet, would clear you. You are your own worst enemy, Mr. President. Knock it off." Now, Lindsey Graham is a menace to society, an advocate, hawk of the, you know, military-industrial complex. But on this one, I think he might be right. 30 seconds left, Ted.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, so what we're looking at now is an environment in which most people, as you said earlier, Brian, are just too busy to follow anything other than the headlines. And the headlines are just going to continue ceaselessly until this president is driven out of office physically or into total irrelevance.
Okay, that's it. We've been joined from New York by editorial cartoonist and columnist Ted Rawl. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Amid an economic crisis, Puerto Rico voted Sunday in a referendum on joining the United States, but with voter turnout at only 23%. And most other parties boycotting it, does the vote really reflect the will of the people of Puerto Rico? We are joined from San Juan by Camilo Punzada. He is a spokesperson for Juventud Trabajadora, the youth wing of the Working People's Party of Puerto Rico. Welcome, Camilo.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you, Camilo. Let me ask you, the referendum takes place in the midst of this vast, profound economic crisis. Large numbers of people on the island are migrating to the United States or elsewhere. Talk about the referendum, where it came from, and does it, in fact, represent the will of the people, and does it have legitimacy?
It doesn't represent the will of the people. It doesn't represent the majority. The referendum is the Law 7 of 2017, also known as the Law for the Immediate Decolonization. But here's the problem. The problem is that the plan for the immediate decolonization has a colony as an option on the referendum. Therefore, most of the parties, well, all of the parties except for the party who's governing right now, who promotes statehood, boycotted the referendum. Now, as you said, it only had 23% of participation, which doesn't even represent half. So, yeah, I would agree that it doesn't represent the majority.
Help the audience, the broader audience that may not know that much about internal politics in Puerto Rico. Who is the ruling party right now? And also, what's the primary cause of the budget financial crisis that has taken even the limited self-governance of Puerto Rico out of its own hands and put it under the domination of a financial control board?
Well, the governing party that's right now, it's the PNP, which is the new the Progressive Party. They promote capitalism, extreme capitalism. They're a right-wing party. This debt is right now at $73 billion. It comes back quite a few years ago. We have a lot of information, a lot of cause to think that the majority of that debt is illegal and unconstitutional. Therefore, the people are asking for that debt to be audited. But the governor right now, doesn't want to audit that debt to the extent that he took down the commission responsible to audit it. We know that he's hiding something. And now talking about the referendum costed $7.8 million, which was enough money to start the audit for that debt. So it's hard to understand, but at the same time easy, I think, that he's definitely up to something. And the fiscal control board, they go hand in hand. Their measures of austerity just want to get rich and make the people poor. That's basically how it goes with them.
What were the actual options that people had to vote on at the referendum?
Statehood, independence, or free association, or the colony as it is right now. Those were the three options.
So right now, Puerto Rico has Commonwealth status, in other words, colonial status. Independence is one option, where Puerto Rico becomes an independent, self-governing country, joins the United Nations, has control over its own land, its own labor, its own resources, has its own foreign policy, its own military. That's one option. A statehood is another option. So according to the headlines, based on the referendum, 97% of Puerto Ricans in the island want to join the United States as a state, or at least that's the way it seems to appear, again, from the headlines following the referendum. What's the actual sentiment of people on the island?
The past referendums have showed that a vast majority of people do want statehood, but I think that has been decreasing significantly. I think it represents not even people who want statehood. It represents people who voted for the new the Progressive Party. I know, for example, people from the party who believe in statehood, and they boycotted actually the referendum. So I think this was a game. It was his game. He played it and he lost, even though the numbers say the contrary.
Yeah. So with a 23% voter turnout, it looks like a big flop. Like this maneuver wasn't as a consequence of the boycott and as a consequence of the fact that the masses of people felt that it wasn't legitimate and stayed away. This was a big political setback for the ruling party, for the governor. Camilo, I want to have the audience hear a short clip. It's from, I believe, 1955, and it talks about how the United States government really viewed Puerto Rico. Of course, the island was seized along with Cuba and the Philippines when America intervened against Spain, trying to seize and did seize Spanish colonies. Of course, Puerto Rico and Cuba and the Philippines both being Spanish colonies. In the case of Cuba, it became a neo-colony, a semi-colony. In the case of Puerto Rico, an outright colony. Same was true about the Philippines. But again, it's very important because this isn't ancient history, the mid-1950s. I want to hear a clip, and it really reflects how the American government told the American people about Puerto Rico and its status. Let's listen to this clip.
Industrial incentives, including 10-year tax exemption and other tax freedoms, have attracted some 325 plants to the Commonwealth since 1948 and created jobs for 50,000 Puerto Ricans. Operation Bootstrap moves forward, and today Puerto Rico is an integral part of the American economic system, a new frontier for business enterprise. The seat of government of the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico is located in the capital on Ponce de Leon in San Juan. The Legislative Assembly consists of the Senate and the House of Representatives, with originally 27 senators and 51 representatives elected by the people. In these days of international strain, popular, twice-elected native governor Muñoz Marin, aware of the agitations of a small minority of nationalistic fanatics and malcontents, administers the affairs of the Commonwealth with clear vision and the loyal support of a stable and well-trained officialdom. But at this stage, neither independence nor statehood will meet the realities of Puerto Rico's economic position.
All right, so I guess if Puerto Ricans who are nationalistic are fanatics, unlike Americans who are nationalistic, who I guess are just patriotic Americans. It says a lot, though. I mean, that was the narrative, and you heard all the happy music, the celebratory music in the background. I mean, talk about how this played out inside of Puerto Rico, Operation Bootstrap, the whole thing.
Yes. Now, you mentioned the happy music in the ending, but I think this is not a happy matter. I think that the United States invaded Puerto Rico. They used us. They gave us the American citizenship for no other thing that to use us for their army, for their wars. And it mentioned also the tax exemption for other enterprises outside of the outside of Puerto Rico. Basically, if Walmart is installed in Puerto Rico, they're exempted from taxes, for example. I think that's something that should be it's like an economic paradise, really, for people who don't live here.
For corporations.
Exactly. I think that they're extracting all the juice that they can for now, but that's my opinion. I think that they've used us. I don't know if you've heard from Vieques. The Marine had several stations over there where they trained, where they put bombs and tested them out. They endangered the environment severely, and they had to be thrown out by the people. That was a huge time where people were socially disobedient for the Marines to get out. But once again, I think that the Muñoz Marín, the first governor of Puerto Rico elected by the people, did not know at that time that he was creating the colony. I think that in his mind he was doing something good, but he is in fact the author of what we're living today. And it's a serious matter. We're in the in between. We're not this, we're not that, but we're certainly a colony, and it's beneficial for the United States. I mean, we don't. We're part of them, but we're not. We don't have voice or vote. We're just there. We're just an economic influence for them.
We're here in Washington, D.C. Washington residents also don't have a voice. I mean, they don't have a vote in Congress. They don't have a vote in the U.S. House of Representatives or the Senate. They didn't have the right to vote for the President of the United States until 1964. This is was certainly a predominantly African-American city, but it had a colonial status. And actually, the license plate here in Washington, D.C. says no taxation without representation, taking from the American Revolution, which was an anti-colonial revolution. Here you have Puerto Rico seized by the United States military by force of arms in 1898, 1899, used as a launching pad again for the creation then of the Panama Canal and the Isthmus of Central America, again opening up the Atlantic coast of the United States both to Caribbean trade but also to trade in Asia by virtue of those sort of stepping stones, Puerto Rico, Cuba, Philippines. Now you have the people in Puerto Rico who are still in a colonial status. I mean, it's quite amazing. If most of the people want to be a state, for instance, what would be the main problem that they would encounter? Why won't the U.S. government give these U.S. citizens, and Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens, the right to vote or the right to be a state?
It's important to have clear. Do the United States, is that beneficial to them? Is it good for them to have another state which has a $73 billion debt, which has been exploded to its maximum extent, which it just leaves us with nothing to offer them? And right now with Trump, it's just crazy to assume that he would want a Hispanic country being a state. That's just, I don't know who would think of that, really.
Right. In other words, just the profound racism that exists in big parts of the United States and certainly within the Trump administration against Spanish-speaking people.
Yeah, yes, that and the debt. I think that it's just, I mean, for example, if I was in their position and some country that has the amount of debt that we have ask us to become a state or part of us, that would just not cross my mind. I think that is absurd. I think that first we have to deal with what we have in Puerto Rico and then decide if we want to be a state or we want to be independent. I think that you have to deal with what's here first and then think of what's going to happen with the status.
Camilo, help the audience also understand the feelings on the island about independence. In one way, it's a very practical matter. Of course, right now, Puerto Rican people living on the island or living elsewhere have the right to U.S. citizenship, although they don't have the right to vote, no right to political power. And right now, their country's economy has been taken over completely, even more so than it had been. But you have the instance of, say, Oscar Lopez Rivera, Puerto Rican independence advocate and fighter, you know, for his whole life. He was sentenced to life in prison. President Obama commuted his sentence right before leaving office at the end of his second term. Oscar Lopez Rivera was put up as the number one person to be honored at the New York City Puerto Rican Day Parade in New York on Sunday. And then, of course, the political establishment went on a full-scale offensive against that, including Mayor de Blasio, but of course the police especially, but others. But here you have independence as a minority sentiment, a small minority sentiment officially, but then you have people like Oscar Lopez Rivera and other independence fighters really on a pedestal, meaning really honored and beloved by the Puerto Rican people. How do you explain the contradiction?
I think that first of all, I want to clarify that us as the working class party, we can't establish a status that we prefer. We have a variety within our members of the party. But I, for example, I believe in independence. I think that us who believe in independence are not necessarily a huge minority. I think that statehood might be a majority right now, yes. But it's not as little as people perceive it because, for example, movements of independence are big right now. I think that in the referendums in the past, usually independence believers boycott them. It's strange now that statehood, people who believe in statehood and people who believe in free association boycotted it. But usually us independence believers boycott that kind of because we don't believe in referendums, for example, or at least not how they're brought up right now. So with that being said, I don't think that we're a minority, or at least not by much. Oscar Lopez fought for what he believed in, and that is to be admired. That some people agree or disagree with his actions or allegedly what he did, because it was never proven that he did such things. He was only charged with conspiracy. So I think that the fact that he fought for what he believed in and he did his time and now he's out and he still is willing to fight for what he believes in is what is to be admired. And I admire it. And a lot of people in Puerto Rico admire it. And we have seen it since he got out, since his commutation was over. So I think that it's not that much that radicals are the only people who back him up.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you about that. It was a genuinely mass sentiment in New York amongst the Puerto Rican community and amongst the Puerto Rican population elsewhere, everywhere, for him. And of course, the long tradition with Don Pedro Albizu Campos, the leader of the Nationalist Party, the massacre directed against what the newsreel film called the fanatical nationalists, who were just people standing up for their country at Ponce. This whole tradition has been sort of wiped clean from the American mainstream media. But undoubtedly, as you're saying, it will come up, and it's come up again with the release of Oscar Lopez Rivera. We've been speaking with Camilo Punzada. He is a spokesperson of the youth wing of the Working People's Party of Puerto Rico about the referendum, which most Puerto Ricans just ignored or boycotted. Only 23% actually participated. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Bernie Sanders has gone on the offensive in the aftermath of Jeremy Corbyn's success in the UK election. Are radical left-wing ideas more successful in stopping the far right than establishment centrism? We are joined from Detroit by Julie Hurwitz. She is an attorney, a lawyer, and an activist. She was on the Rules Committee at the Democratic National Convention. She was a Bernie Sanders activist. Welcome back, Julie.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining. Julie, Bernie Sanders spoke at the People's Summit in Chicago in the last weekend. Of course, this comes right after the surprisingly strong showing of the left wing and the Labor Party in the UK, led by Jeremy Corbyn, on Thursday in the Thursday election, a really surprising advance for the Labour Party. Let's listen to Bernie Sanders at the People's Summit 2 days, 3 days later, and then I want to get your comments about it. Here's Bernie Sanders.
All over the world, people are asking, how does it happen that globally the top 1% now owns more wealth than the bottom 99%? How does it happen that the 8 wealthiest people on this planet own more wealth than the bottom half of the world's population, 3.4 billion people? And just the other day, in the UK, against all of the predictions, the Labour Party there won 30 new seats. And they won those seats not by moving to the right, not by becoming more conciliatory. They won those seats by standing up to the ruling class of the UK.
Standing up to the ruling class, new rhetoric from Bernie Sanders, obviously feeling very strong about what happened in the UK, and also making a point, even though he's been on a unity tour with Perez, the chairperson of the Democratic Party, who was part of the Obama cabinet, and it appeared that there was unity between the conciliatory centrist or neoconservative wing in the party and the Bernie Sanders wing. This sounds like different rhetoric. What do you say, Julie?
Well, I think that Bernie is speaking to his audience. And I think that ultimately what the message that he sent at the forum on Saturday was what he really stands for. But he's also a pragmatist to some degree and so knows that in order to shift the balance of power in this country, he feels he has to work with the right wing within the Democratic Party.
But it goes completely against what he just said. He said they didn't move to the right. They didn't conciliate with the right wing. I mean, his whole point was by not conciliating, Corbyn surprised all of the predictions and came out. So it appears contradictory to his own strategy.
Well, one might posit that I think what he believes is he's going to be able to move the Democratic Party to the left. Not that he and his platform are going to be watered down or diluted, but that his message and his platform is beginning to resonate with enough people in this country that the Democratic Party itself is going to have to move to the left if it wants to address the legitimate concerns and mindset of the millions of people who, for some reason that I still can't quite fathom or wrap my brain around, shifted to the ultra-right agenda of the Trump campaign. And I think he rightly saw the failings of the Democratic Party in their inability to speak to those concerns. And I read an article just a few days ago in which there's chatter now going on about the Bernie Sanders message being now embraced by members of the Democratic Party who previously wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah, I don't see that happening. I mean, personally, I think the Democratic Party elites, I mean, once they vanquished Sanders and his supporters, including yourself, you were there at the Democratic Convention.
Yeah, I was.
After day one of the Democratic National Convention, after Sanders' movement was vanquished, the Democratic Party actually moved to the right. I mean, it sounded like the Reagan Republicans and a little bit to me, all that chanting USA, USA. And then the entire campaign of Hillary Clinton was Donald Trump is sort of selling out the country to the Russians. And that America must stay strong. And in other words, pursuing an openly neoconservative, aggressive, militaristic agenda. And she lost. Now, the Democratic Party elites, as we know from the WikiLeaks tapes, the revelations, the emails, they actually sabotaged Sanders.
Yeah.
The Labour Party sabotaged Corbyn. If Corbyn did not have the – if Corbyn had had the full backing of the Democratic – of the Labour Party parliamentary wing – he would have actually won. He probably would have won the majority. But these people are never going to stop sabotaging the left wing. And Corbyn finally stood up to them and defeated them. And that's why he won all this popular support. I mean, do you actually think Sanders believes that the Democratic Party is moving to the left, or is he positioning himself?
You know, I can't answer that question. I do think that the election in the UK this past week occurred at a critically different moment than the November 2016 election occurred in the US. And I think that, rightly or wrongly, the mass consciousness in this country just refused or put a blind eye to the reality of what the alt-right movement is about in this country, as did the Democratic Party, and to a large extent, as does the Democratic Party still do. It continues to turn a blind eye to the dangers that we are currently facing, but I think enough people are seeing some of the immediate consequences of an alt-right ideology and were able and willing to step up in England to say no, to begin the process at least of saying no. We're not going to let this happen here. I'm hopeful that we are able to come to the same conclusion in this country before it's too late.
Sanders said after returning to a UK speaking tour, he said, where he was in the UK, he said in Brighton in the UK, quote, "What I think Brexit was about was a lot of people who felt left behind by the global economy and their voices and their pain was not being heard. What upset me was the Democratic Party more or less ignored that reality. What Democrats have got to do is to have the courage to look at that pain. Trump understood that reality and spoke to that reality. Unfortunately, he lied, but that reality exists. It wasn't so much that he won the election, it was that the Democrats lost the election." Now, it seems to me that the Democrats have gone out of their way to defeat Keith Ellison, who was Bernie Sanders' candidate for the DNC national chair. Mm-hmm. They've gone out of their way to really reaffirm the same losing strategy mm-hmm. that cost them the election. They're, in fact, all they talk about is Russia, 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 as if Russia was really the reason swing voters in Michigan and Wisconsin and Ohio and Pennsylvania, many of whom voted for Obama in 2008 and 2012, either didn't vote or, in this case, voted for Trump when Sanders was knocked out of the campaign.
Well, ultimately, we all know the Democratic Party represents, to a large degree, you know, maintaining the current institutions as they exist. You know, it's all about the status quo. We know that. We know that huge amounts of corporate money go into supporting Democratic candidates. We know that it's a structural reality that anybody in power within the context of this system is going to be fighting and working to maintain the power relations that already exist. And I think that's always been true of the Democratic Party. There, of course, are substantive differences in social justice questions between the Democrats and the Republicans, but ultimately the economic balance of power is going to be maintained regardless of whether the Democrats or the Republicans hold office. What I thoroughly agree with, however, in the Sanders camp is the strategy of focusing more on upsetting those balances of power at a local level and working your way up, building a truly grassroots movement in this country. And I think he truly believes that that can happen. Whether it happens within the Democratic Party or outside the Democratic Party, I don't think he's that concerned about. He's willing to work within the Democratic Party, but I don't think he's wedded to that. If a viable third-party alternative emerges, I would think that Bernie Sanders would jump on it. Personally,
well, we have the Green Party. We have some smaller socialist parties that are running electorally. Of course, the parliamentary system in the UK means that a party like the Unionist Party in Northern Ireland, which is an extreme right wing party that only got 10 seats, still can tip the balance for a hung parliament. So people can kind of vote the way they want to, and it doesn't mean that they're, quote, throwing their vote away. But in this winner-take-all system, if the Democrats don't win, then the Republicans win. And they win, as we could see, both here in the 2016 and in the 2000 election, even if they don't win the popular vote. I mean, the Republicans have only won the popular vote one time since 1988. That was in 2004 when George W. Bush defeated that awful candidate named John Kerry. I mean, the only Democrat to lose a popular vote since 1988. And yet, in spite of those kind of numbers, because it is winner take all, the left seems to always, unlike in the UK, fold its tent and say, yeah, we're gonna back the establishment. Like Bernie Sanders says, the Democrats lost. It wasn't that Trump won, but Bernie himself was campaigning for that losing candidate, Hillary Clinton, whose campaign was so miserable. I mean, what are the options for the left?
It's a dilemma we find ourselves in this country. And, you know, I have a 23-year-old son who is grappling with these questions. He's very active in progressive issues and community struggles here in Detroit. And he is grappling with these contradictions, what to do, how to make a difference, how to make and build a movement in this country that will result in the kind of fundamental substantive changes that we believe are necessary without buying into what you're describing as sort of a, you know, a lesser of two evils mindset, which seems to govern our entire mass consciousness in this country. And I don't know the answer to that other than we just have to keep on having hope in our young people. And we have to, I do believe getting involved in electoral politics at the local grassroots level can, over the long run, if we survive the short run, can make a difference in building the kind of mass movement for social, true social justice and economic justice in this country that is horribly necessary. I don't know if that resolves the question. I don't think it does. But I agree with you that the system in which we function, this winner-take-all electoral system, has been set up from the beginning to maintain that the powerful elites will continue to control the machine. And unless that and until that gets redefined, we just have to keep on struggling on all fronts.
Yeah, there's a new initiative that's underway here in Washington, D.C. called the People's Congress of Resistance. And that's having its initial meeting at the third week of September at the Blackburn Center at Howard University. And that's bringing together grassroots resistors from all over the country, hopefully from all 50 states. And the point of that Congress in the convening statement is that the U.S. Congress, it's not just Donald Trump, but the U.S. Congress itself represents these elites. They represent the 1%. They represent Wall Street. They represent the military-industrial complex. And as a consequence, as the Democrats and Republicans wrangle over whether or not Donald Trump is an agent of Russia's meddling in American democracy, so-called, the Congress itself isn't stopping the Trump program, which is destroying the environment, cutting and smashing people's health care.
It's horrible. I mean, it's brilliant in its horribleness. It's just one has to step back and wonder how much of this is just some sort of decoy that's been set up to focus us all on this, you know, on the question of I actually believe there was collusion. I believe there was obstruction of justice. But it's like we're all so focused on that he's able to just quietly enact all of these extremely frightening domestic policies and put these people into positions of power that are going to have long-standing impact on our daily lives, and no one's paying attention. And it's really scary to me when I look at the courts and what he is going to do to our judiciary and ultimately to the interpretation of our Constitution. Because the Constitution is not set in stone. It's a constantly fluid document, always subject to whoever is in the position to interpret what those words mean. And when he puts his people into those seats, which he's already started with Justice Gorsuch, we are in deep trouble, and we better be ready for a huge fight down the road.
I agree with you. I think that you could see Gorsuch's his own record. I mean, he was the only judge in that case of that truck driver who was going to freeze to death if he didn't get relief after his truck broke down. And Gorsuch said the company was right to have fired him because he left after 4 hours of being in a hypothermic state because he didn't have rights. He was just, of course, a worker. Yeah, just a worker. And, of course, I agree
horrific.
With...
I mean, talk about inhumane. Oh, my God.
Yeah, it really is. And it's a cabinet of oligarchs, billionaires, generals, Wall Street. It's not the...
Yeah, everything he said he was going to turn around, he went and made even more entrenched. And here we are. But I think that, you know, we are at a critical moment. I think that now is the time more than ever in this country, at least in my lifetime, where the idea of, where the notions of the fundamental contradictions of capitalism are starting to be understood by more people, where the idea of socialism is starting to not resonate with so much fear and backlash, where people who've never been activated before, who've never paid attention before, are starting to pay attention and starting to say, "Whoa, no, this is not right. We have to stand up." And so we're going to be looking at some pretty interesting movements emerge over the next period of time. It's going to foretell how our country is going to proceed in the future.
Yeah. We've been joined from Detroit by Julie Hurwitz, a lawyer and activist. She was a delegate on the Rules Committee at the Democratic National Convention. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.